Hey, this is the King of Bros, and you're listening to Saw Monsters Sound Off.
It's business time, baby.
The Saw Monster Sounds Off.
My client!
Mama Monster!
Conquered the street!
We like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me!
Delete! You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
It is the Christmas edition of the Saw Monster Sounds Off, episode 578. Here for Sunday, December 23rd, 2018, I am the Saw Monster. We've got my nuts roasting by an open fire. Later on, I'll be digging into my giant sack with all of your mailbag questions. I've got a giant load of them this week. Plus, we're down to number 6. In our list of the top 10 greatest championship matches in Royal Rumble history, last week it was John Cena and AJ Styles for the WWE title at the 2017 Royal Rumble. Could there be another John Cena match this week? I don't know. I guess you'll just have to wait and find out. I see that John Cena is going to be at Madison Square Garden this Wednesday. I'll be seeing him then. My brother and I got tickets to the post-Christmas MSG house show. His new Bumblebee movie's gotten a lot of really positive reviews. I saw it had something like 96 or 97%, I think, on Rotten Tomatoes. I also get to see Matt Riddle making his Madison Square Garden debut. They're having this giant NXT 10-man tag on the show. It's going to be Pete Dunne, Matt Riddle, Ricochet, Aleister Black, and Velveteen Dream taking on Tommaso Ciampa and the Undisputed Era. So that should be fun. That day after Christmas is also my father's birthday. He would have turned 61 years old this year. Were it not for him, I may never have even been a wrestling fan. Pretty good chance I probably would not have been a wrestling fan. At least not today anyway. He and my grandfather were at MSG for the very first WrestleMania. He even brought me back a WrestleMania logo t-shirt, which I still own. I still have in my possession to this day. I know it's in one of, it's in my closet somewhere, I think. It'd be comical if I tried to put that thing on. Belly shirt would not even begin to describe what that would look like. So, you know, to remember him, it's appropriate that we will be at MSG on Wednesday. Cena is not working any TVs, only house shows, starting with the Garden. He loves working those live events. He really does. He's not interested so much in being on TV. I mean, can you really blame the guy? Can you really blame him, especially now, wanting to be as far away from TV as possible and only do live events? You know who else loves doing live events? Batista. Every time Batista talks about wanting to come back for one last run, I really don't want to just do a one-and-done type of thing at WrestleMania. I'd love to come back, and I want to work all the live events. Yeah, he's more than one time he's been on the record as saying that. And, you know, it's why I laugh when I saw some of the reactions last week that I put up to the video, the clip from the show last week, when I put it up on the YouTube channel, where somebody asked, you know, if a WWE offseason would be, you know, practical. I don't think it would be practical. It's a nice idea in theory. And some of the responses were just, you know, well, just get rid of the live events. Problem solved. You know, people aren't as stressed. They're not working as much. They're not getting hurt as much. Just get rid of the live events, forgetting the fact that, yeah, I mean, it's a lot of travel, but a lot of the talent actually likes the house shows. A lot of them have fun on the house shows. They probably prefer them to TVs. They get to try out new things before using them on TV, new moves. They probably get more ring time, longer matches generally on the house shows. And, you know, just if you've ever been to a live event, you know, just the chance to probably goof around more than you can on TV. TVs are very stressful. You're under a very tight, strict schedule as far as in and out. Especially now, Raw has no overrun anymore. You've got to be off the air by a certain time. There's so much talent, a surplus of talent that they have. You only have a finite amount of time, and you've got these scripts, and you've got it, you know, right down to the second. And so I can see where TVs probably wouldn't be nearly as fun as just being able to go out there and work. At the end of the day, that's what you need to do. You just have to go out there and work. imply your craft and get better. That's how it happens. It doesn't happen by just working TVs. And I think people tend to forget that, you know? And what makes you think the talent would want to eliminate house shows? I think that would be a bad idea and not one that would be very well received behind the scenes. So I saw that response a few times this week and I chuckled because I don't think people really fully thought through those answers when they gave them. Audible continues to be a great partner to the podcast as we wind down 2018, another year. I am very appreciative of their support and your support in using our Audible link. I hope you continue to do so because it means a lot to the show. AudibleTrial.com/Solomonster is our unique URL. If you plug that in and you sign up for the 30-day trial of the Audible service, you get to sample it for 30 days, and you get one free audiobook of your choosing. And the cool thing about it is that even if you cancel before those 30 days are up so you don't get billed, you know, maybe it's just not your thing, that book that you cashed in on the Sound Off, you get to keep. It's my Christmas gift to you, and there's a lot of really good ones up there. Just wrestling. Forget all the non-wrestling. Bob Holly, Justin Roberts, Daniel Bryan, Chris Jericho, Shawn Michaels, Steve Austin, Brock Lesnar, Hulk Hogan. If you're a big Hulkamaniac, I mean, tons of wrestling books up there that you could choose from. Just plug in audibletrial.com/Solomonster. And if you'd like to become a PayPal VIP, you guys know the drill. You can always do so on thesolomonster.com. PayPal button is always parked there on the right-hand side of the page. And $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out as we go through the holiday roll call here. I want to say thank you to everybody who has been, really all year long, not just this week, a supporter of the show via PayPal, but especially this week, thank you to the Belgian Brute, Nicholas Overmeer, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, who is vacationing with the missus over in Hawaii. Very jealous. A lot warmer, I'm sure, than it is here where I am in New York. John Luis Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Bryant Becerra. I think the music in the background is kind of soothing here for the holidays. Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Luis Hercules Hernandez, the Marietta Mahler Alexandru Mata, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Stephen Handyman Halistic, Super Jock Michael Cochran, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Misery Inc., Chris Matthews, The Macho Messiah, A.C. Smith, Merry Christmas, my friend, Defined Real, thank you for the support. Also, a belated birthday shout-out for Final Boss, Brian Dudley, Better Than Raw, Robert Michalczyk. I think a staph infection would be Better Than Raw these days. Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, along with Luke, Hunter, and the entire Soep clan. Happy holidays to all of you. Emmanuel, the Big Nasty Briseno. You know, Emmanuel's name when I first came in through email. I don't know why, but it made me think of those old Emmanuel movies that I used to put Cinemax on late at night. Looking for, of course, action and comedy movies, not looking for anything else. And I would be flipping on Cinemax on a random late night, and they would always have these Emmanuel movies. And I don't know why I thought of that, but I did. So thank you for that. And last but not least here, Victor. I want to say thank you to Victor. I saw your review on iTunes. Very appreciative of that. So thank you for the love on there. Thank you to everybody who watched my Sound Off Extra review for last weekend's TLC pay-per-view to the tune of, I think, 115 or 116,000 views now. Yeah, I'm always amazed by the support that I get. And to see that video outperforming the review, for example, on a big channel like Cultaholic, which has over 400,000 subs, it's just a really cool thing to see. So if you want my thoughts on TLC, you can find them there, the full-blown review, all 30 minutes of it. Actually, it might have been more than that, but the overwhelming majority of you did agree with me based on the results of the Twitter poll I put up. The sentiment being that it was a thumbs-up show. I think the final poll was by a margin of, I think, 78 to 22. That's a pretty overwhelmingly positive response for the pay-per-view. Was it a perfect show? I don't know that I would say it was the best WWE pay-per-view of the year. If you made a top five list, it probably would be in that top five. But I thought we had an excellent TLC main event with Asuka winning the women's championship from Becky Lynch and Charlotte, rather. Excellent WWE title match with Daniel Bryan and AJ Styles. Their best match yet since being matched up here in WWE. And on the flip side, we had Dean Ambrose winning the Intercontinental title from Seth Rollins in a very dull match. And I'm sorry, I know there were a decent number of people who vehemently disagreed and they thought that those two guys got a raw deal and the match was actually very good. You must have been watching a different match than I was. I've seen those two have really good, exciting matches before. Case in point, their lumberjack match stands out to me from SummerSlam a few years back. So it's not like these two are incapable of going out there and having a fun, exciting match. This was not one of them. When you do the sizzle reel years from now down the road of the best of Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose, you're going to see some of their matches on there. This will not be one of them. And it has more to do with just the positioning of the match on the show, which didn't help them. But it was just a boring match. The only match in the entire card before or after that I had to catch myself from falling asleep. You know, just call it a loss and move on. Hopefully the next time, you know, they have a better match. But I can't say I'm overly excited to see them matched up again. I'd rather they not be. I'd rather they each move on to other opponents. But yeah, that was one of the few dark spots, I think, on that show. By the way, speaking of the YouTube channel, I have started uploading some retro clips to the channel, starting with the top 9 countdown that I did a couple of years back of the top 9 WWE promos of all time. Why top 9? Because at the time, I was celebrating the 9-year anniversary of the Sound Off. So before people start asking me, that's why it's a top 9, not a top 10. The first one went up on Friday. I think it's going to be a Friday thing. So every Friday for the next 8 weeks, there'll be a new clip from the countdown going up. The first one's already up, talking about the Mr. McMahon Life Sucks and Then You Die promo from SmackDown. Arguably his best promo, I think, of all time. And like I said, every Friday a new one will go up until we hit number one. There's a lot of people that never saw, never heard that countdown. I know TV Trax used to have a lot of those clips on his channel. A lot of that got privatized and taken down for various reasons. So it only makes sense to start getting some of that retro content up on days where, you know, late in the week, I usually don't have anything new going up. So I thought that it just made sense. And when everything is up, the cool thing about it is, and I'm going to do this with the Rumble countdown as well, the cool thing with the YouTube channel is I could just organize everything in a playlist. And so down the road, if people want to refer back to these things, all of the clips on these lists are going to be organized in one playlist. So everything is organized in one place. Impact Wrestling will have a new television home in the new year on the Friday before Christmas, when hardly anybody is really paying attention. Really any Friday, I mean, take it from me. Friday is a bad time to be putting out a press release, and it is normally a day where news is kind of sent to die. You sort of bury certain pieces of news on Fridays that you don't necessarily want to draw a whole lot of attention to. And so I thought that was interesting that of all days they chose that one to make this announcement, or maybe the network did. But they dropped the news that they are leaving Pop TV and premiering on Pursuit Channel starting January 11th. At 10 p.m. Eastern. Now, if you're asking, what the hell is Pursuit Channel? You are not alone. What they are is that, first of all, they're based out of Alabama. It is an outdoor channel that focuses on hunting, fishing, and shooting. So the outdoors, very outdoorsy stuff, which is funny because Impact, last I checked, doesn't film shows outdoors. It might be the only thing on the channel that isn't really outdoors. But yeah, it's going to be a real pursuit to find this channel on most cable providers. I can tell you that Anthem, which owns Impact, has a stake in this channel, which would explain how they ended up there. I don't think it speaks very well for the interest in their product right now from other TV networks, if this is the one that they landed on. There were multiple discussions, apparently, with multiple potential television partners. It's not as though This was sort of the first choice, and they just went with it. I don't know the names of the networks they talked to. I've seen some reports. They're not confirmed, but they definitely were in conversations. And the fact that this is where they landed, I see some people saying, well, maybe it's only a temporary landing spot. Well, yeah, maybe. But, you know, if my aunt had balls, she would be my uncle. I mean, we can play that game if you want to. But the reality is, this is probably the network that Impact is going to end up on for much of 2019. Until they bounce around, of course, and move to another network that's even smaller than this one. That's probably how this plays out. Not a good sign that they end up on a channel that is owned by their parent company. Now, this is Impact's fourth network domestically in 4 years. I said this once here on the podcast. I said this show has more moves than Bruno Mars. Four networks in 4 years. If we include the early days on Fox Sportsnet, which I believe was a time buy for them, let us recount all of the moves that Impact has had since then, since the Fox Sports days. Okay? The show started on Fridays, then it moved to Saturday once they shifted over to Spike, then Thursday, then Mondays, where they got slaughtered head-to-head against Raw. Then they dragged their bloody carcass back to Thursday, then moved to Wednesday before the move from Spike to Destination America. Then they moved to Friday, then back to Wednesday when Dixie Carter accidentally sent an email bashing Destination America executives, sent it to Destination America executives by accident because LOL TNA. Then they moved to Pop TV, and in doing so, moved to Tuesday, and eventually to their current slot on Thursday. And now they're moving to Pursuit Channel, where the show is going to air once again on Friday. Sunday, I'm pretty sure Sunday is literally the only day of the week that Impact has never aired. That comes next, after the eventual move to public access television, which seems inevitable at this point. Now, I will say, you know, they do seem to have some solid international TV deals. That money, honestly, may well really be the only thing keeping them solvent at this point, is the money from those international TV contracts. But after 16 years, this company still cannot seem to gain any traction whatsoever. And this is despite having some great talent under contract right now. They've got a lot of names that, you know, I recognize from Lucha Underground. You guys know I'm a big Lucha Underground fan. Now, again, the storylines are different, the way the show is filmed, it's not exactly like Lucha Underground, but the talent they have is top-notch. You know, believe me, a lot of the talent they have, WWE would love to get their hands on. Either for the main roster, or for NXT. You know, there's a lot of guys on that roster, I think, who are very valuable, very talented. And despite that, they still cannot seem to gain a foothold. They just cannot seem to gain any traction. Now, for their sake, I hope they're at least making more money on this deal than they were on their Pop deal. PW Insider said that their Pop contract was said to have been worth about $1 million a year to them, which is more than I thought. And I see some reports this deal might be even possibly for a little more than that. So they're making some money off this. You know, they're not a public company, so we can't be 100% sure about the numbers here. But, you know, I hope they're at least making decent money from this. Now, starting in the fall, if they last that long on there, on Friday nights at 10, Impact is going to be airing immediately after SmackDown. This is after SmackDown moves over to Fox on Friday nights. They're going to be going from 8 to 10. Impact, in theory, would then, if they stay in this slot, be airing from 10 to 12 immediately after SmackDown, which sounds like a good thing, but that's only if people actually have the channel. Now they have much of the year to kind of tell people where they are and hopefully get more clearances for the channel. That's not an easy thing to do, but there's, you know, a good 9 or 10 months now between now and then for them to kind of prepare for SmackDown moving to Fox. And hopefully people would then say, oh, you know, there's more wrestling on. Let me flip over to Impact and see what's going on. Again, in theory, that's a nice idea, but how many people even in October are going to have Pursuit Channel? You know, I mean, I check on my cable provider. I don't have it. I mean, I'm in New York. I have Optimum. I don't have it. But if you have Cox Cable, you should have it. If you have AT&T UVerse, you should have it on there. It should be channel 1644 HD. Verizon Fios should be HD channel 818. Dish channel 393. And DirecTV channel 604. But like I said, I know for my cable provider here in New York, I have cable, not satellite. We do not have a Pursuit channel. But Friday's going to be a busy night for wrestling come next fall. You're going to have SmackDown. You're going to have Impact. You're going to have MLW. New Japan on Access airs on Friday nights. BN Sports, which airs MLW, and Access Television are hardly channels that have a huge following either. So I don't want to make it sound like we're just, you know, picking on Pursuit Channel and it's the only channel with barely any audience. There's a lot of wrestling on TV these days. And much of it, non-WWE, are on stations that don't really have wide-scale availability. Or just because they do doesn't mean that you have a lot of people actually watching the shows. And that's the key, right? If you have a network that's got clearances in 50 million American households, that doesn't mean that you're going to have 50 million people watching your show. In a lot of cases, it may only be in the tens of thousands. So, you know, everything, you got to put some perspective on this. So let me just be very upfront with that. I recognize that BN Sports and Access Television are hardly big channels themselves. Same for El Rey. El Rey Network airs Lucha Underground, or it did anyway. But as of May of this year, Pursuit was available in 28 million homes. Now, by comparison to Impact's former homes, Destination America is available in 47 million homes. Pop TV is available in 68 million homes. And the Paramount Network, which used to be Spike, is available in 81 million homes. El Rey, by comparison, 44 million homes. And BN Sports is kind of at the bottom of the list here, 22 million homes. Now, I don't know if it would be allowed per the terms of their new contract, but they should really think about doing what MLW does, which I think is very smart of them to do, and put their shows on their YouTube channel. First of all, it's going to generate more traffic for them. In theory, it would generate more traffic for them and more subs on their YouTube channel. They could do what MLW does, wait a day or two. See, MLW is smart. What they do is their show will air on a Friday, and they upload the show to their YouTube channel at 6:05 on Saturdays. Of course, 6:05 used to be when WCW Saturday Night would air, and so for old school fans, it's kind of a nice little throwback there. Wait a day or two, put them on your YouTube channel. At least not only would you get more eyeballs that way, you'd get more ad money. Now, they could always do Twitch. You know, they've aired things on Twitch before, but they're not going to get the traffic on Twitch that you would get on YouTube, or the ad money. So I think it's a must for them, unless there's something in the contract that stipulates you can't do that. But, I mean, again, 16 years, this company has been in business well more than MLW, well more than Lucha Underground, 16 years. Having had some of the biggest names in wrestling at one time or another under contract. And a ton of young talent that has gone on to, in some cases, great success in WWE. Which I think is great validation in many ways for TNA. You know, but 16 years only to share a network with the Bear Whisperer and crappy Masters TV. I shit you not, that is the actual name. That is a real TV show. Crappy Masters TV. Crappy as in the fish. I should specify. Some of the other shows you can enjoy if you are lucky enough to have Pursuit Channel. Bird Dog Wars. Bone Shack Outdoors. Carnivore TV. Oh, Daniel Bryan ain't gonna like that. Double Lung TV, which is maybe one of the more bizarre names for a television show I've ever seen. You would think maybe it's some sort of medical show. it is not. So that's Double Lung TV. There's another show called Girls with Guns. Save the Habitat, Save the Hunt. And Wipe 'em Out Outdoors, which you can imagine what that's about. So Impact Wrestling now joins that lineup. you know, hey, maybe they could tweak the show to be a better fit for the network, you know, where the fans get to hunt the wrestlers. And the ones who survive are the ones who can run the fastest. But 16 years, somehow they have managed to survive. Through all of the turnover in management, in talent, in television networks, in time slots, even through Josh Matthews on commentary, somehow they live on. Which is good for the talent. I mean, it gives them another group and another option, another place to go. Well, you know, when I was at the Hall of Fame ceremony a few months ago for Abyss, there was a noticeable camaraderie there amongst the talent that I thought was very admirable, and it was very cool to see. It's a very, you know, tight-knit group of people that they have working for Impact right now, and some of the older faces, Abyss being one of them, Abyss being one of the TNA originals. And to see him and the love he was getting, and you could see how much it meant to him, not just to be honored, but in talking about how Impact has gone through all of these different evolutions, and here, after all these years, the company is still around, to someone like him, that means a lot. And he's more than just a wrestler now. He works behind the scenes for them. He works creatively for them. And, you know, you see that, and how can you not root for someone like that and want to see them succeed? But if you're an Impact fan, it's got to be demoralizing to see them constantly taking one step back. Or if they do take one step forward, then they take three steps back. This has been the story of TNA for years. This has been the story of Impact for years. Getting away from the TNA name, which obviously I still haven't, getting away from the TNA name, though, for them was a must. And they did that, although they kept the Impact name, so it's not like they completely blew things up. Maybe that's what they needed to do. Maybe they needed a complete break and a complete fresh start, you know? Maybe the damage was already done. Maybe the damage was just too great from all those years of total and complete ineptitude. You know, you've got Ring of Honor running Madison Square Garden with New Japan in a few months. ROH started the same year that Impact did, 2002. They have their own issues. But there's no reason that they should be running MSG, and Impact at this point can't. But of course, you think about the concept, even the idea of Impact running Madison Square Garden, and the thought of it even, is comical. And it didn't have to be that way. Not with all the talent and the names that they had. But here we are. Raw Monday Night was in Sacramento, California. We had over 4,300 votes, which is a much bigger than normal total in our Twitter poll. 21% thumbs up, 33% thumbs down, 46% did not watch. And that 46 number is a lower percentage than in recent weeks, which correlates to a higher Raw rating this week. See? So as the didn't watch option goes in our Twitter poll, that's usually a pretty accurate reflection of whether the ratings are going to be up or down. And the rating was up this week, which you expected it to be, because they promoted Vince McMahon coming back and shaking things up. So the rating was up a decent amount, and in our poll, the didn't watch option was lower, because there was obviously some interest in seeing exactly what Vince was going to do. Now, I recorded a Sound Off Extra Monday night after Raw was over, talking about the show. I just could not wait until the weekend. The big shakeup that was the McMahon family will now be in firm control of Raw and SmackDown going forward. Good to know, after all these years, that the McMahons are finally taking control. I had a good laugh at that one, as you heard on the review. I had a hearty belly laugh at that one. So great it was that I've now incorporated it into our opening intro for the show. That was the big announcement. That really, when you break it down, was the big announcement. Now, there were some other little announcements that came out of that. They have eliminated both general manager positions for now, until they eventually come back. And they are putting more power, they said, in the hands of the fans. They are putting more power in the hands of you and I. We, Triple H said, are now the authority. So I guess that means we're going to be hogging up way too much television time and making most of the baby faces on the roster look like total losers. I can't wait. I can't wait to exercise my authority. Stephanie was out there. All the McMahons were out there, including Paul McMahon. But Stephanie's out there and she's saying, you know, we're out here tonight because we have not been doing a very good job for you lately. I don't know that truer words have ever been spoken on Monday Night Raw before. They have not been doing a good job for us lately, as evidenced by their eroding audience on Monday nights. Even what's that guy's name on YouTube? Tyrone Magnus. I'm a fan of some of his videos. I saw a video pop up this week from Tyrone Magnus. He's got this huge audience on YouTube. And even he did a whole video, like a 10-minute video, talking about why he doesn't watch WWE anymore. He had to tap out. When you've lost Tyrone Magnus, you're doing something wrong. So they talked about how in the coming weeks and months, there's going to be new faces and new matches. And Triple H promised, you know, that they're going to shake things up in that way. And they're going to deliver the show that we deserve. Well, we're now heading into their Christmas show and their New Year shows here at the end of the year, which you can just throw away. You can really take the next 2 weeks and just throw them in the waste paper basket. They mean nothing. The real test is going to be that January 7th show. That's when we need to start seeing some real changes on this show. And I don't just mean new faces cycling in and out. I mean real changes where you put the show on and within the first 10 minutes, within the first hour, it just feels fresh in some way. Maybe it's the way they shoot the show. Maybe it's the way they transition from one segment to the next. It's got to be more than just cycling new faces in and out. Because if the show is produced in the exact same way, with the exact same over-the-top crappy commentary, and the same trend, Raw rolls on, let's go to a commercial break. Raw rolls on, let's go to a commercial break. There's just a certain sameness to this show that has to be destroyed. It has to be killed, it has to be murdered, it has to be buried, and it has to be forgotten. New year, you know, what's that expression? New year, new me. When people say that, I want to smack them in the face. But in this case, it applies. For Raw, it's got to be new year, new me. Or else this is all just hollow words. This means nothing. It won't take very long to realize whether or not they're full of shit. Based on their track record, very few things ever really change. Because, again, Vince McMahon, at the end of the day, is still overseeing the show. And I saw the interview, I saw the transcript anyway, I didn't hear it, but I saw Jimmy Jacobs, I mentioned him last week, and things he was tweeting out about how hard it is to write a 3-hour show. And I saw he gave an interview, I think, to The Observer, and really detailed the creative process in WWE. And when you're done reading it or listening to it, your head will spin. And you think to yourself, how do these people get anything done in the course of a week? They're worked to the bone. It's a 24/7, 365 job. But one of the recurring themes throughout what Jimmy Jacobs was saying, even as he tried to defend Vince McMahon and defend the process, he kept coming back to this idea that everything is conceived of and written and done with the idea in their minds, is Vince going to like this? And I get that it's his product, it's his company, it's his show. He should have final say in the product that goes out. Look, I didn't have a problem with Vince having final say in the 90s. Vince can have all the final say he wants as long as he's putting out a product that people like. Clearly, that's happening less and less. But over and over again in this interview, Jacobs is saying, we're writing and thinking of things and doing everything with the idea in mind, is Vince McMahon going to like it? And that right there is the problem, the biggest problem of all. Because they're writing, I've said this before, they're writing for an audience of one. They're not writing for an audience of 2 million or 3 million. And yes, the fans sometimes don't even have a full grasp on what it is that they want. Everybody's got their own ideas. You can't please everybody. That's true. I get that. But they're writing for an audience of one. They know what Vince likes. They know the kind of crude humor he likes. They know the things he doesn't like. Or the talent maybe that he doesn't like. And they worry, oh my God, is Vince going to like this? Is he going to yell at me? Is he going to snap at me? I know the kind of promo segment that he likes. Let's write it in the way that he likes. That's the worst thing that you could be doing. That interview that he gave only confirmed all of the awful things that we've been thinking about how this whole process works. They write for Vince McMahon. Maybe they need to start writing for their audience. Maybe they need to start writing for you and me. And worrying less and less. But they work for him? I get it. I understand why they feel that way. I don't know how you bridge that gap. I don't know how you fix that. It's easy for me to sit here and say that, oh, they shouldn't be writing everything for Vince. They should be writing with the fans in mind. They should think of things from a fan perspective. Okay, but then if they pitch it to Vince, he's just going to snap at them and blow it up anyway. It's a no-win situation. It goes back to what I've said before. This guy has been the showrunner of Monday Night Raw for almost 26 years now. And he's had a lot of success. He's the most successful wrestling promoter that there's ever been. And, you know, when the day comes that Vince is here no longer, you're going to hear a lot of wonderful things about him. There's going to be a lot of tributes to him and all the changes and things he did for the wrestling business. And a lot of it is probably true. For all the bad, there was a lot of good. There's never going to be another person like Vince McMahon. But I do think that when you finally remove him from the equation and you get some new minds and new faces in there, maybe Triple H just slides into the Vince position, but I'd like to think he'd be a little more open-minded to new ideas and new ways of doing things. Until that day comes, we're just not going to know. Look, maybe Triple H takes over and things are worse. I find that hard to believe. Until that day comes, we just don't know. But I read the transcript of that interview, and I shook my head the entire time. First of all, it gave me a headache reading about how the whole process works. It's so frigging disorganized and ridiculous. And his argument that, no, 25 writers is fine. If anything, we need more. And he was very much against the idea of having less than 25 writers. Well, of course. What do you think? The writers are listening to everything the fans are saying and they're going to sign on with all these thoughts. Oh, when people say fire the creative team, boy, things used to be easier when it was just Vince McMahon and three other people. That's the last thing they want because they'd be out of a job. What do you think these people are going to say? Of course the writers are going to disagree with that viewpoint. Their fucking jobs are on the line. They're going to do whatever it takes to protect their jobs. They know things would probably be a little bit easier to manage if there were less of them. They're not going to admit that. They're not going to say that. Because then they'll be unemployed. The whole process is fucked. But reading the transcript of that interview did not make me feel any differently than I already felt. I'll say this much about the show this week. It was only week one, but the look and the feel of the show didn't feel any different to me. The faces may change, but if nothing else does, these are empty promises. Now, story-wise, I think a power struggle, I mean, look, we have to accept the fact that if you're going to watch these shows, it's going to be the McMahon family hour, or three, if it's Monday Night Raw. That's just the way it is. So the McMahons are going to be on television. It's not the ideal situation, but okay, so how do you make the most of it? Storyline-wise, I think a power struggle between Vince and Triple H could be interesting, depending on how that plays out. You know, I said when I did my Raw review on Monday, when I put it up on YouTube, I said, if you look at what they promised and the vignettes that are already airing for new talent, and I'm going to evaluate these first six NXT call-ups here in a second. When you look at that, the pieces are sort of in place. If they wanted to go in that direction, Triple H, you could, you know, see the writing on the wall here. He is trying to fill these rosters and flood these shows with more and more of, quote-unquote, his talent. And they could incorporate that into a storyline, into a power struggle if they wanted to down the road. Now, I also think that a Triple H Shane McMahon feud could be interesting for all the reasons I've outlined before. You guys have heard me say, because there's got to be real emotions buried in there. Here's Shane, the guy that was the heir apparent. I remember reading stories in you know, the dirt sheets and the internet news sites back in the late 90s. When Shane was first really becoming a television character and becoming more involved, I remember reading reports even then that Shane was going around and introducing himself to the talent and the ideas that, you know, they want Shane to become acquainted with the talent. One day he may be their boss. Well, here we are 20 years later, and boy, things didn't turn out that way now, did it? Here's the kind of the lion cub he was going to take over one day until Triple H slid in and basically took his spot. Took a spot that would have belonged to, well, probably Shane and Stephanie both, not just Shane. There's got to be buried deep down there some real emotions. When Shane came back, he did a network podcast interview with Mick Foley. I think it was Mick Foley because Steve Austin, I think, wasn't available. Or maybe Chris Jericho wasn't available. But he did an interview on the network, a sit-down podcast interview. And I remember the question coming up, what do you think of Triple H? Or it was something like wanting his thoughts on Triple H. And I don't remember his exact words, but the answer he gave was very, very telling. He basically sidestepped the question and really wouldn't answer the question. And I remember watching that and thinking to myself, holy shit, there really could be something here. Because the best storylines are played off of real emotion. Unfortunately, WWE has taken that to heart sometimes in a very tasteless way when they play off people's deaths and tragedies and things of that nature. I'm not talking about that. But when you're able to play off something real and genuine, I think that those typically make for the more interesting stories. I'm telling you, there's a story there. If they wanted to dig in there, Triple H and Shane, plus maybe they end up having a match at WrestleMania, and you know they're both going to have a match on the card. Why not just consolidate it and put all the McMahons in one match? Let Triple H and Shane have one match that they take up on the card. They can beat the hell out of each other and leave the matches to the actual, you know, talent. I think that would be a fine idea. So, again, I think either of those stories could be pretty interesting. But reshuffling the deck chairs is just not going to work. They have to renovate the entire deck. Where the chairs go really isn't as important. Now, there were other positives coming out of the show. Baron Corbin is no longer the Raw General Manager. That's a plus. The automatic rematch clause that they've leaned on storyline-wise as a crutch for so many years appears to be no more. I'll believe it when I see it. It's kind of funny because I'm going to talk about SmackDown in a second and a match they announced and then kind of unannounced. And that ties into the whole automatic rematch clause. I thought they already went back on it. Now it looks like that may not be the case. But the way Shane McMahon was talking about it on this show, there was a backstage segment with him and Drake Maverick and AOP. He called it antiquated. He certainly made it sound like the automatic rematch clause would be no more. It has been abolished. That is a good thing. It should not be an automatic that every time you lose your championship, you get a rematch. Think about that practically. If you're in a tough match against a tough opponent, you're getting your ass kicked at the pay-per-view. What is the incentive to being completely and thoroughly destroyed and dismantled when you can just lose the championship and know, well, I'm just going to get my rematch the next night, or I'm going to get my rematch at the next pay-per-view. It's all good. I don't think that it should ever be an automatic. And they've leaned on that for so many years. You know what? It's about time they abolished that stupid rule. I'm not saying that when you lose your championship that nobody should ever get a rematch. I'm not saying I'm against the idea of Becky Lynch facing Asuka, although I wouldn't do it at the Royal Rumble. I'll talk about that later. But it shouldn't be an automatic for every single person every single time they lose a title. So I like that. I think that's a plus. We have the Revival on this show. They want a Fatal 4-Way to earn a tag team title match against Bobby Roode and Chad Gable, which takes place tomorrow night. And no, I'm not giving spoilers away here because the show is already taped. If you want to know the spoilers, you can find them online very easily. We had Natty in the main event. They basically took the entire third hour and gave it to the women and did a 50-some-odd minute long gauntlet match to determine who would face Ronda Rousey for the Raw Women's Championship this Monday night on Raw. And in the end, it was Natalya. Natalya won the nearly hour-long women's gauntlet on Monday Night Raw. That is not my idea of exciting television. Natty winning an hour-long women's match. She wasn't in there the whole time. But yeah, that is not my idea of fun. And there was some decent action in here. It was not by any means a Seth Rollins-esque performance. Nobody had that, you know, gauntlet performance like he had on Raw earlier in the year. That match was actually a lot of fun to follow. This one, not so much. But you know what? Now they can blow off the Ronda-Natty thing tomorrow night. Because Natty's not beating Ronda. And that's not a spoiler. That's just common frickin' sense. Natty is not beating Ronda. And so they can blow this match off, which I'm sure they've wanted to do for a while now. And they can move on and get Natty out of the picture. All due respect to her. I don't want to see her wrestling for the championship. There is nothing about her that excites me enough to want to see her headlining the women's division on any brand right now. So do the match, one and done, move on, please. Let me talk about the NXT call-ups, because one of the things they announced on Raw and SmackDown this week, they aired a vignette with highlights of six new NXT call-ups coming up very soon. There's no specific dates on these, but they're coming up very soon in the weeks to come. Lars Sullivan, who we already knew about, EC3 is getting the call-up. Now, he was supposedly going to be called up after SummerSlam, was hurt. I think he suffered a concussion, and so that pushed things back. He never did get called up. Now he is. Lacey Evans, Nikki Cross, and Tucker and Otis of Heavy Machinery. Those are the six individuals who are getting called up. Let's start with Lars Sullivan here. Sullivan is being promoted as a monster, and I still think the best place for him is on a brand with fewer monsters, with fewer people who look like him, who are as big as him, who are as tall as him, or bigger than him in some cases. Braun Strowman, for example, is much bigger than Lars Sullivan is. I just think Raw has enough big men already. SmackDown is where he should land. That's assuming, of course, he can recover from the drubbing he received on Twitter this week from the now former SmackDown Women's Champion. Becky Lynch wins for Savage Tweet this week. Ronda Rousey wins for Most Bizarre. The two of them have been back and forth on Twitter again, going at each other. And they were talking about the Raw where Becky put Ronda in the disarmer. This was the Raw episode before Survivor Series where the SmackDown ladies invaded. Becky led the invasion charge on that show. And again, she put Ronda in the disarmer backstage, right? Becky had called her a little weirdo in this tweet. And Ronda said, well, you're the one jumping on me while I'm getting changed in the locker room. And then she put a bunch of hashtags in there, including this very odd one. Hashtag, I know you left with my underwear. Yes, Ronda Rousey accused Becky Lynch in storyline, I hope in storyline, of stealing her underwear. In a creepy way, it kind of makes sense now why Becky calls herself the man. So Becky, in response, said, just how hard were you kicked in the jaw that one time, you little freak? Alluding to the UFC fight where Ronda got kicked in the face and beaten by Holly Holm, which really was the beginning of the end of her career. Well, Lars Sullivan, why do I bring all this up now? Well, Lars Sullivan, of all people, thought it would be wise to stick his nose in the middle of all of this. Would not be the first time that he has posted something stupid on social media. He took exception to Becky calling Ronda a freak. He said, he's the only freak around here. Becky then posted a photo of Conor McGregor at that famous UFC press conference where Jeremy Stephens talked about, he was talking shit, and Conor is kind of sitting in a row in front of him. And Conor just turns around. He's like, who the fuck is that guy? He's like, he doesn't know who the fuck it is. And so she just posts that image, and everybody knew what that meant. Lars then pulled the old tweet and delete out of embarrassment. Becky noticed this and said, I think I broke Lars. And at that point, he just tweeted, just got nailed by the man, had to delete. Look at this guy, buried before he even makes his debut on TV. He would be best suited to keep his mouth shut, I think, until he makes his debut. And that's also something else. It's a minor thing that annoys me, but part of the reason I wonder if why some of these people don't really get over the way that in another bygone era they might have. You could say, oh, work rate, things are different now. People put more stock in work rate than they would have, 20, 30 years ago in WWE. And that's probably true, although I wouldn't. Look, you had to know how to work then, too. You couldn't just be, a warm body in the ring. If that's the case, then Giant Gonzalez would have been the fucking world champion. But yes, things are definitely different now in that respect, but when you have a guy like Lars Sullivan, who they're building as this monster, right, and this freak, and then he goes on social media, he goes on Twitter, and he says dumb shit. I don't know. I mean, it takes away, I think, from the aura they're trying to build with some of these people, right? Am I the only one who feels that way? I know it's a minor thing, it's not that big of a deal, but I do think social media takes away a lot of the mystique from a lot of these people, and that's got to be part of why they just don't seem to get over the way they used to, or just be these larger than life personalities the way that they used to. That's one of the drawbacks, I think, frankly, of social media. It humanizes these people. When there was a mystique about them and you didn't really hear from them or see them outside of what you saw on television, I think that worked a lot better, especially for someone like Lars, the way that he's being portrayed. So yeah, he didn't do himself any favors there. But anyway, he's on his way up. We already knew that. I hope he goes to SmackDown and not Raw. EC3 has a look that Vince McMahon, I'm sure, probably loves. In fact, he probably took one look at him and said, I want that guy, and so he's being called up. He's got charisma. I've yet to see any classic EC3 matches in TNA or in NXT, unless you count the ladder match he was involved in when he first came to NXT, but, you know, he was one of six guys. I mean, I guess you could count that one. But now he's going to have his chance. I think he should go to Raw. I think he should be a heel, even if he comes in initially as a babyface. It's the Bobby Roode thing. When Bobby Roode was in NXT, he was already a heel. That was the right role for him. When he got promoted, he debuted as a babyface. And I thought, well, all right, this is stupid, but maybe it's just a temporary thing. Give it a few weeks. Well, here we are. He's been on the main roster at least a year now, probably more. And he's still a babyface. Now he's one half of the Raw Tag Team Champions. Good for him. But boy, the Bobby Roode on the main roster is not the Bobby Roode that I was hoping for when he left NXT. In the case of EC3, he's a babyface right now in NXT, and probably will be when he first debuts, but I wouldn't keep him that way for very long, because I just don't think that's the best role for him. Nikki Cross. Nikki Cross is very good. Putting her back with Sanity is the predictable move, but what have they done with Sanity since calling them down to the main roster? Nothing. Oh, this week. Oh, they shook things up, right? This week they finally showed up again on television. I forgot they were even employed. But they showed up on television again this week because it's a new era with new faces that aren't really new, even though they've been around. We just haven't done anything with them. But they're new. It's like you buy a shirt, right? And I've had this with dress shirts for work. You buy a shirt, you wear it, and all of a sudden one day you stop wearing it. It's in your closet, you forget it's in there. Years could go by. 5 years later, you're in your closet poking around. Hey, look at this. Here's a shirt I haven't worn in a long time. And you start wearing it again. All of a sudden, what's old is new again. You didn't buy that shirt. That shirt's been sitting in the fucking closet for 5 years, collecting dust. All of a sudden, what's old is new again because you haven't used it. That's what they do with their talent. Their talent, it's like a shirt that they buy. And they wear it one time, they get bored with it, so they put it back in the closet, and eventually they remember they have it, and they figure, well, we should probably start using it again. Let's start wearing it again, at least for a few weeks, until we get bored. And then we'll go play with our new toys. And that's how they've treated Sanity, like an old shirt. So why would I want Nikki Cross in her debut to be put back with a faction that was DOA? Just because they're back on TV this week doesn't mean I have any faith they're going to do something with them. You put Nikki back with Sanity, and my fear is that they do more to drag her down than she does to prop them up. I think the SmackDown Women's Division needs new faces. I think she should probably go there. So at least they'll have the option if they want to, with them being on the same brand, of linking her back up with Sanity whenever it may be convenient for them to do so. But to me, it's not an automatic that she should end up back with them. In fact, I'm in favor of her not going back to Sanity, at least not right away. Lacey Evans. Lacey is tall, she's blonde, and so you know that she's going to get a big push. No doubt about it. She would get pushed with those attributes, even if she didn't have any real in-ring talent. But in this case, she does have talent. There's other women I would have preferred to see over her first, but she's good. She's good enough. Comes from a military background, I'm sure they'll push that fact. I think she was a Marine. So, in terms of work ethic, I'm sure, you know, her work ethic is top-notch, and she's working to improve and working to get better. If she keeps improving, I think she could turn into something special. I just thought that's what NXT was for, silly me, but it feels less and less like that's the case these days. And then there's Tucker and Otis, Heavy Machinery. They've been a favorite act of mine now on NXT for a while. You've heard me talk about Otis Dozovic before. The man looks like a walking, talking human version of an old King Kong Bundy LJN action figure from 1985. The way he walks with his arms hanging down, it's so unnatural. It's just like he's like a walking box that has arms sticking out of it. And of course, I've seen people online make the Chris Farley comparison. Chris Farley was a funny SOB. Now imagine if he was also a champion Greco-Roman wrestler. You now have Otis Dozovic. He may also be the first Serbian WWE star. I don't know if his parents or his grandparents are from there. He wasn't born there. He was born here. I know that. But I can't think of another main roster WWE star from a Serbian background. He may be the first. Whatever you do, just don't watch a Serbian film. I made that mistake many years ago, and it traumatized me greatly. Sean Ross Sapp on the Fightful.com podcast said that Vince McMahon is very high on Otis. He took one look at him and he loved him, because of course he did. Is that good enough, though? Because the track record for tag teams from NXT is not good. You look at the Revival. You look at AOP. Sanity, who I just mentioned. They kept American Alpha together for all of 5 minutes before they broke them up. The Vaudevillains. Even Enzo and Cass, although their downfall was due to a bunch of different circumstances. They were at least getting a push. Point is, NXT tag teams generally do not get called down to the main roster and do well. I could see Vince liking Otis enough to break them up and transition him into a comedy role as a single down the road. And he is very entertaining. I am not against the idea of him doing comedy stuff. Let that be known. But he could be doing more than just comedy if you give him the chance. So when I look at all six of these people, and I think which one of them has the potential to be the next big breakout star, though I do like Otis, I don't think it's anybody from this bunch. I don't think it's any of these six, including Lars, who might get a big push out of the gate. I don't see that one person or team in here that's going to go on to, in 2, 3, 5 years, we're going to look back and see them main eventing and headlining. Just don't see that with Lars. I don't see it with EC3. I don't think it's anybody from this group. And if I had to pick one, honestly, but you know what? If I had to pick one from this bunch of the six people, it's probably Lacey Evans as the one who I could see being a dominant champion at some point. But I really don't think this particular group is going to yield anybody like that. When they're ready to call down Aleister Black or Matt Riddle, that'll be a different story. Those are two names who I think could be main event players on the main roster sooner rather than later. There was a closed captioning typo on the Hulu version of Raw. An Instagram user spotted it. He snapped a photo. The on-screen graphic said Ronda Rousey Live coming up next. And I believe it may have been Michael Cole doing the voiceover, the preview for the next segment, and not Corey Graves, even though Corey, you know, he tweeted about it. What he said was, Ronda Rousey, the baddest woman on the planet, explains her actions at TLC. They were hyping her upcoming appearance later in the show. That's what he said. The only problem with that is that the Hulu caption said something a little bit different. It said, Ronda Rousey, the fattest woman on the planet. Oops. Sounds like something Becky Lynch would tweet about her. You guys know my love of closed captioning botches for Monday Night Raw. I once did a whole segment on this. I ran down some of the classic ones from years ago. These go back to like 2009, 2010, the ones that I talked about. Because they used to badly botch the lyrics, the opening lyrics to Randy Orton's theme song. This is going back like a decade now. So I have no idea if the closed captions still do this. I suspect they don't. But back then, you know, so for example, 1 week, instead of I have voices in my, or I hear voices in my head, they gave us some gems like I have oysters in my bed and I have boys in my shed, which is one of the more disturbing ones. But I think my all-time favorite is still, I ate poison, now I'm dead. I remember First time I read that, my sides hurt so much. I was laughing so hard. There was another time where Chris Jericho was talking about Mickey Rourke. So this would have been before WrestleMania 25, which tells you how far back this goes. And in the closed captions, you know, he referred to him as Mickey Mouse instead of Mickey Rourke. Like, imagine being a deaf person at that time, right? And wondering, why is Chris Jericho cutting a promo on Mickey Mouse? And why does Randy Orton have boys in his shed? They talk to him. They understand. These are more entertaining than the actual show. I wish the closed captions still fucked up the way they used to. That would be supremely entertaining, way more so than Raw is in a typical week. So tomorrow's Raw was taped immediately following last week's show that same night, which meant 6 hours straight. Those fans in that building, the ones who stayed anyway, were subjected to 6 straight hours of Monday Night Raw. Maybe it was a little less. If they're going to fill the show with pre-taped segments, maybe it wasn't a full 6, maybe it was 5.5. 6 straight hours of Monday Night. I thought they had laws against torture. So it's no surprise there were reports of large swaths of people walking out in the middle of that taping. I'm sure they'll edit it, you know, in such a way where the building looks full and we don't really notice it. You know who used to be really good at that? In all honesty, I'm not even joking. Impact. Impact had developed a knack for a while there, especially when they would go on the road. Because for a time, they left the Impact Zone. They were taking Impact out on the road. That didn't work out too well for them, so they ended up coming back to the Impact Zone. But they developed a knack during the Dixie era of having a half-empty building, or more than half-empty building, but making it look full on TV. When you would watch those shows on television, they look good. And if the crowd was loud, you would never know that the building was 65 or 75% empty. So for a while, they had developed a knack for that. WWE can do the same thing. They have to. Because, was it last week or the week before? I think it was actually this week. There was a point, and maybe it was before the main event, where Daniel Bryan was coming out, where they, and they typically don't do this, but they filmed his entrance in such a way. Or maybe the Usos were coming out, I don't remember. But you saw the side of the building that was empty. Usually it's just pictures that people post on Twitter. We actually saw on the show that entire side of the building, which is probably the hard camera side, but it was more than just the little nest area where they have the hard camera, completely empty. Completely empty. I had a friend text me and go, why are there no fans? Like, did they close off that whole side of the building? And I said, no, they don't close off an entire side of the building. They just can't fill those seats. It looked bad. So they actually did a really bad job, I thought, on the television on Tuesday of kind of covering for that. But they're going to have to when they air that Raw show tomorrow night. Now, SmackDown was live from Fresno, California this week. Twitter poll was quite a bit different than the Raw poll, over 3,200 votes. 50% thumbs up. That's the first time I think either Raw or SmackDown in these polls have cracked 50, maybe in a couple of months. Only 6% thumbs down, 44% if you said you did not watch. Over on the SmackDown side, Shane McMahon relieved Paige of her general manager duties. She is no longer the SmackDown GM, which is too bad because, as many of you have said, I agree, she was actually pretty good in the role. I think with her not being able to wrestle, not being allowed to wrestle, it was the best role for her to get her on television. And now Shane said that she's going to occupy a different role. She's not going anywhere. So what does that mean? Is it going to be basically a GM light, you know, where she's an assistant to Shane McMahon or something like that? I'm sure her being an assistant, by the way, would go over real well. Yeah, let's not do that. But they did not specify what the new role would be. I will only say this. Please, 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 I hope it is not her becoming part of the announce team. I don't think that would work. I just don't think that would work. And I think back to when she was a judge on Tough Enough, and I know that's not exactly the same thing. Paige can be good at a lot of things. I don't think commentary is going to be one of them. And I have no idea if that's something they're considering or not, but I really hope, because I kind of dread them making that announcement. I just figure, they got Renee Young on Raw. Let's have a woman on SmackDown too. Let's boot Corey Graves out of there because he's on both shows anyway, and replace him with Renee Young, or with Paige rather. Corey's been getting on my nerves a lot, too, more so on Raw than on SmackDown. But I could absolutely see them considering this. And I just think that would be a terrible mistake if they did that. I just don't see her being a good fit for that role. So I don't know what role they have in mind for her, but I just hope that's not it. By the way, that little interaction during the opening segment, I don't know if you noticed, Shane had huddled the entire roster together backstage for a group meeting, team meeting. And they showed on screen Big E was eating, I think, a hamburger, unless it was something else, steak or something. It looked like a hamburger to me. He's standing there eating a hamburger, staring down Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan is, of course, the vegan psychopath he is. In storyline, he is no longer a vegan in real life. I don't know how many people realize that. He has not been, I think, for a few years now. He was, legitimately, for health reasons. But it wasn't as though he was a vegan just for ethical reasons. It was more of a health thing for him. I don't believe he is vegan anymore, so in real life, I'm sure he doesn't give a shit. But it's funny in storyline to watch, because he's portraying this sort of, you know, like I said, this vegan psychopath who is trying to save the world, and he is just staring a hole at Big E. It's just the look on his face, and the look on Big E's face, who's making just one of the weirdest facial expressions you'll ever see, was just comical. So on Main Event this week, let's talk about this story here. On Main Event, of all places, Scott Stanford, who does the voiceovers for the show, he announced that Becky Lynch would be getting a rematch for the SmackDown Women's Championship. She would have an opportunity to get her title back against Asuka at the Royal Rumble. I saw the video of it, so I know this actually happened. They put the graphic up on the screen, he announced it. And the first thing I thought when I saw that was, well, so much for this abolishment of the automatic rematch rule. That lasted all of, what, 4 days? Well, the very next day, WWE obviously had Paige go on her Twitter and tweet out that the match, in fact, is not official. She said, "So I tried to make one last match before my time as SmackDown Live GM came to an end. But unfortunately, Becky Lynch against Asuka for the Women's Championship is not official for the Royal Rumble. Oops," she said. Oops, indeed. That sounds to me like they just forgot their own segment from Monday, with Shane calling the automatic rematch rule antiquated. Although they can just incorporate that into the storyline now if they want to. They can have Becky come out and accuse management of being against her, and maybe that's what they'll do. Maybe they'll turn this into a storyline. But really, it just comes off as a case of the right hand not knowing what the left hand is doing. I saw John Pollock of postwrestling.com. He reported that the match was planned and was going to be announced on SmackDown. And then they decided that the entire Royal Rumble card, in light of the shakeup, would now have to be reevaluated. And the studio, unfortunately, had the old information. And that's why it made TV the way that it did. So indeed, the right hand did not know what the left hand was doing. As good as that match could be, I think a Becky-Asuka singles match could be really good. I would rather they not do it, because there's no good outcome. Forget the fact that Becky should be in the Rumble, which she absolutely should be. You could do both. Roman Reigns did it a couple of years ago. There's no reason Becky Lynch can't do it, but forget that. There's no good outcome if you do that match at the Royal Rumble. Either Becky wins the championship right back, which makes no sense if the end goal is Becky against Ronda, unless they're going to do a title unification match, which I'm sure they're not. It makes no sense. And it's a very short run for Asuka, her first real challenge, and she loses. I don't think anybody wants to see that. So either Becky wins and that happens, or Becky loses, which is the last thing that should happen. Losing at TLC was a must, but she should not be losing on back-to-back pay-per-views. And any possible thought to not having her in that Royal Rumble match would be creative malpractice. And it would be 2014 all over again with Daniel Bryan if they left Becky out of that match. So singles match or no singles match, Becky Lynch must be in the Women's Royal Rumble. That is a must. That is non-negotiable. There's no reason for her not to be in that Royal Rumble match. And she needs to win. Not only does she need to be in it, but she needs to win. And have her choice of either Asuka, Charlotte, or whoever the champion may be at the time on the SmackDown side, or challenging Ronda for the Raw Women's title at WrestleMania. That would be her choice, and that should be the match at WrestleMania. Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed in that regard. That should be the pathway to WrestleMania. Now, it was a huge night on SmackDown for Mustafa Ali. He was permanently added, we were told, to the SmackDown Live roster. And in the same night, he pinned, yes, he pinned the WWE champion in the main event. It was AJ Styles and Mustafa Ali against Daniel Bryan and Andrade Cien Almas. Ali and Almas both working the main event of SmackDown. You know what? I like the sound of that. It won't be like that every week. But when I think of shake-up and I think of changing things up, first of all, SmackDown was the last show that needed to be shook up. Not that they don't have their own problems. The real shake-up needed to happen on Raw. So when they started talking about the McMahons are back and Paige is fired as the GM and we're going to take over, I thought to myself, you keep your damn hands off of SmackDown, okay? SmackDown doesn't need your help the way that Raw does. Raw needs a complete makeover and a complete shakeup. SmackDown, I think, generally most weeks, it's hit or miss, but it's more hit than miss. There are definitely changes that could be made, but this whole idea of, well, we got to shake everything up, SmackDown really didn't need a shakeup the way that Raw does, okay? So leave SmackDown alone. This, however, is a change I can get behind. And I've been saying this on the show for a while. How can I not be happy watching this? How can I have any reaction other than thumbs up in full support of what I saw here? Because I've been saying Mustafa Ali, Buddy Murphy's another one. I'm sure in time he'll make his way to Raw or SmackDown as well. But Mustafa Ali should be hanging with guys like Seth Rollins and Samoa Joe and people like that on the main roster. I never thought that out of the gate he'd be wrestling with and pinning the freaking WWE champion, but that was a cool moment, what they did there. You know, watching him out there with Bryan last week, watching him out there with, you know, Bryan and Almas as part of the tag team match this week. This is what I've been asking for this guy, and now they're giving it to us, and I think it's a great move. I think it's a smart move. There's so many great potential opponents for him. Not just Daniel Bryan. AJ Styles, Randy Orton, Jeff Hardy, Rey Mysterio, Samoa Joe. So, you know, if they really do have enough faith in this guy to use him in a meaningful way, you know, even if it's kind of mid-card, upper mid-card, I think that, you know, Ali could do very well for himself. Now, Ali was on Lillian Garcia's Chasing Glory podcast recently. It's a great interview, by the way, worth going out of your way to listen to. You'll learn a lot more about this guy, his background, his upbringing, his family. But one part of the interview that has been isolated in light of what happened at the end of the main event on SmackDown on Tuesday was him talking about his finisher. Now, his finishing move is basically it's kind of like an inverted 450, hence he calls it the 054. And in the interview, he admits that when he executes the move, literally, he said when he does the maneuver, he has no idea where he's going to land or how it's going to end. He says he literally closes his eyes and he jumps. He says his body just takes over and he just jumps and he tucks. He doesn't know what's going to happen. He says, somehow I land where I land. I know my body and I know what I'm comfortable with. People see these spectacular falls and these nasty bumps and I feel like I'm in control. Well, unfortunately, he wasn't completely in control at the end of the match on Tuesday because there was a big scare with Daniel Bryan where when he hit the 054, he landed with his knee right on Bryan's face. It was either his face or his throat. Bryan was clearly either hurt or stunned initially. There was some talking. You can hear Mustafa Ali apologize to him. I think he said, I'm sorry, bro. He was checking on Bryan, and he pinned him. They went to the finish, which was the planned finish. He pinned Daniel Bryan. He got the shock win. This wasn't quite 1-2-3 kid pinning Razor Ramon on Raw back in 93, but this was sort of the modern-day version of, holy shit, you know, this really just happened. And they played it up like it was some kind of big shocking thing, which, you know, in a lot of ways, it was. That this guy from 205 Live is just added to the main roster and he pins the WWE champion. But fortunately for him, Bryan is fine. He not only is he fine, he came right out for the next taping. They taped two shows that night. He was out there for the next taping later in the night. He's lucky that Bryan is okay. The next time he might not be so lucky. I think it might be time to start paying attention to your body when you do the move, after admitting that he doesn't. He just lets his body go where it goes. probably time to be a little more cautious about where your body lands. It's a cool looking move. I love the move, but the idea that I would be wrestling someone who admits that he has no idea where his body is going to land as he's falling on top of me, that's not something that would make me very happy if I was in the ring with him. And, you know, this could have easily turned into a bad situation, especially with Brian. You know, you always worry about him because he's been okay so far, knock on wood. Hell, he's the champion now. But, you know, that next concussion that he suffers could be his last as a wrestler. I don't doubt that if he gets hurt like that one more time, a head injury, a really bad concussion, WWE would pull him. I don't know if there's something in his contract. I don't know if there's something he had inserted into his new deal before he re-signed that said if something like that were to happen, I have the ability to basically walk out of my contract and go work somewhere else, because I'm sure he wouldn't want to have his contract frozen the way it was before. Brian wants to work. He wants to be a wrestler. Clearly, he could still go out there and do it. I don't think he would want WWE to take that away from him again. So every time there's any kind of head bump or mishap or something like that, you worry. That was my first thought when I saw that. He looks stunned. And I thought, oh shit, I hope he's not concussed. So yeah, Ali's going to have to be more careful on that. But Brian was fine. He did not get hurt. So in the end, all's well that ends well. Now let's talk about Almas here. Andrade Cien Almas, although he did appear in that main event on Tuesday, is reportedly not happy with his position in the company. This is per a report from Super Luchas, who has broken news about, you know, luchadors before. Now, this follows comments that Dave Meltzer made on his podcast a few weeks ago, where he was talking about Roosh. Roosh, of course, big-time CMLL name, just started working in MLW. MLW, in fact, is building their WrestleMania weekend show around a big match between Roosh and LA Park. And Meltzer made the comment that WWE would love to sign him. They would love to sign Roosh, but one of his best friends is in WWE and is very unhappy right now and probably told Roosh that. Super Luchas outed that name as Cien Almas, as the one who is unhappy. This is not the first time that reports have leaked about Andrade being unhappy. The first one goes back to his days in NXT before they finally figured out, you know, what to do with him, and they put Zelina Vega with him, and as a heel, he just took off and did very well and became the NXT champion and really turned his career around when it looked like he was going nowhere fast. There was a period of time where he was very unhappy and thought about leaving NXT. He even gave an interview to a Mexican newspaper a while back and admitted that. He said that he wanted to leave and go back to Mexico. And it was Alberto Del Rio who talked him out of doing it and convinced him to stay and give it a chance. And obviously, at least for a while at least, it worked out well for him and it was the right decision. Gran Metalik is another luchador said to be unhappy with his position in WWE. He put a poll up on his Twitter page recently asking if he should go to CMLL or if he should hit the independent scene. And then he obviously thought better of it and took it down shortly thereafter. That's according to LuchaBlog, who saw the tweet. These are guys who, you know, in both cases are supremely talented. And even Gran Metalik, when he first came in, there was a lot of fanfare and a lot of things said about him, about how great he was, and, you know, they added him to 205 Live, and for the longest time, they did nothing with him. And I want to say he had some kind of a visa issue, and that might have been part of why they didn't do anything with him for a while. But even when that was resolved, if that was what happened, you know, look, when you're stuck on that 205 Live roster, it might be a good place to be for some guys, but he certainly didn't come off as being that big of a deal, even though he's a very talented, you know, wrestler. And so you got these guys who are supremely talented and can make a good living going back to Mexico. They can make a good living working the indies. They can work, you know, make a good living working for companies and promotions like MLW or going to Japan, or, you know, they've got options. Their names would command top dollar. Cien Almas, if he hit the independent scene, you don't think his name wouldn't command top dollar? You know, he had a big name before he signed with WWE. And he'll have as big of a name, if not bigger, if he leaves WWE. He would do very well for himself. I'd hate to see it. I would hate to see him walk out. I think he could be a very valuable piece of that SmackDown roster. And, you know, any kind of shakeup that this company might be doing in the weeks ahead should include him in those plans. You know, he got called down to the main roster in April, and he has not done much of anything since then. And him being part of the main event this week was a nice start, but that doesn't necessarily, you know, that's not necessarily indicative of him getting some kind of big push. And if he is unhappy, I hope that, you know, they can address that and start using him more often on TV. I think him and Vega together are a great package. Yeah, look, Rusev is challenging Shinsuke Nakamura for the United States Championship on SmackDown this Tuesday. And no spoilers, but if he were to win the championship on that show, I like Rusev and all, but I would transition that title off of him if he wins it and get it onto Almas in the next couple of months, maybe even at the Royal Rumble. And then I would start a program heading into WrestleMania for the U.S. title between Almas and Rey Mysterio. That would be the WrestleMania match. It would be Almas against Rey Mysterio. Sad tweet this week is a case of mistaken identity, and a most unfortunate one for WWE Hall of Famer, the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, who has since deleted the tweet, but the internet never forgets. That, and also he left it up all day on Friday, so I mean, you know, at that point, just own it and laugh it off, but I guess he didn't find it too funny. Ted was responding to a Flashback Friday tweet from Stephanie McMahon. Stephanie posted a tweet saying, "Happy Holidays from the McMahons," and in it she included a photo of a very young Shane and Stephanie posing together when they were, I mean, I don't even want to venture how old they were. They were very young. In response, DiBiase said, "Merry Christmas, two handsome young men there." It's like, oh no. Oh no, Ted. Oh no. You can't buy your way out of this one, Ted. The comments and the memes underneath were just hilarious. And to be fair, the multi-million dollar man, as Hulk Hogan used to call him, to be fair to him, Stephanie really does look like a little boy in that photo with that mushroom bowl haircut, which I always wanted when I was a kid. My hair just wasn't long enough for it. I look back now and I thank my lucky stars I never had it. But the fact that he didn't realize it was a throwback photo and he called one of the owners of the company a handsome young man, if that isn't said tweet-worthy, then I'm sorry, I don't know what is.
Let me remind you, and I think a lot of people here will agree, NXT is way better than the WWE.
NXT this week, we had the in-ring debut of the other two horsewomen, Marina Shafir and Jessamine Duke, taking on Dakota Kai and Io Shirai. No new updates on Dakota. The thought was that she may have torn her ACL a couple of weeks back, but there's been no further word since then other than a tweet that she posted of her hanging out in the water back home in New Zealand. And she looks fine. There's nothing on her knee. So I take it she must be okay. I'll say this about Duke and Shafir. You know, for two people with only a few months of training, or maybe several months of training, but they haven't been at this very long, I thought they looked okay. You know, they were just okay. They weren't overly good. They weren't overly bad. They're not really naturals, I don't think, at this the way that Ronda is or even Shayna Baszler is. But this is why you keep people in NXT and you don't rush things. There's no need to try to rush some kind of horsewomen versus horsewomen match for another, honestly, for another year or so. There's no need for it. I'd wait until they're all up on the main roster and then build to something at that point. And these two should spend much of the next year right there where they are in NXT. The moonsault by Io Shirai finished off Marina Shafir for the win. That earned Shirai the fourth and final spot in the Women's Fatal 4-Way this Wednesday to determine who will challenge Shayna Baszler for the Women's Championship at TakeOver in Phoenix. I was leaning towards Mia Yim, if you remember last week, because I just figured that Kairi Sane was going to be slotted into the four-way. And I figure Mia Yim gets sort of the surprise win, and she can be a placeholder challenger, you know, until WrestleMania. But now that I see Io Shirai is in there, I think Io wins it, and I think she gets the shot at the Rumble. Keep that storyline going, where the horsewomen are sort of beefing with Dakota, Io and Kairi. So I think Io's going to win. Next up was the formal NXT debut. We've already seen him on TV a few times, but this was the official NXT debut for Donovan Dijak, now going under the name Dominik Dijakovic. He destroyed this guy, Aaron Mackey. Feast your eyes for the finish. It's his version of basically a go-to-sleep. He gets the guy up in a torture rack position, rolls him over, knee to the face on the way down. You know, for all the talk about a guy like Adam Cole being too small for the main roster and Vince won't push him, he's too short, Dijak doesn't have that problem. I see he's listed online as 6'7". I don't know if that's a work height or a legit height. If he's not 6'7", he's got to be every bit of 6'3 or 6'4". He's a tall guy, and he's also a very good wrestler. So I think if he can progress personality-wise or find some sort of persona that works for him, he's got all the tools to do very well for himself on Raw or SmackDown. He does not have the whole size issue that a lot of those other guys have. Two guys who are main roster bound are Tucker Knight and Otis Dozovic, Heavy Machinery. They squashed default jobber team number 9 here. The size differential here was just comical. It's like they went out of their way to find two guys who were as small as you could, like they found two human Funko Pops to go in there and get squashed by Heavy Machinery. So they were in there embarrassing these two poor bastards when the Undisputed Era walked out on stage. This distracted them for all of a second, but not enough to lose, like so many baby faces before them. They hit the compactor for the win. We were reminded that these two have not lost a match in 6 months. They have been groomed for this moment, as they are now in line for a tag team title shot against Undisputed Era. I think we all know how that ends, given that they're on their way down to the main roster. And you know, sometimes guys win on their way out. A lot of times they lose. You know, they kind of do the honors. It's like leaving a territory and moving on to a new territory. So I suspect that when this title match takes place sometime in the next few weeks, Heavy Machinery will be on the losing end. And in the main event, we had Johnny Gargano and Aleister Black inside a steel cage. This was very good. Came down to Gargano climbing out over the top while Black was crawling towards the door. It was a race to see who would hit the floor first. And as Black was poised to climb out the door, Tommaso Ciampa appears. And he slams the cage door on Black's head like it's Christmas in World Class in 1981. Or 1982, whatever fucking year it was. And instead of climbing out and winning, Gargano sees this. He decides to climb back inside. And he has a stare down from across the ring with his former tag team partner. And all of a sudden, they work together. They hit stereo kicks, their old move. Stereo kicks to Aleister Black's head. And Ciampa leaves the cage. Johnny gets the pin. And we got a heel DIY reunion, if only for a few seconds here. It was pretty cool. Now, my hope is that it leads to at least one tag team match where they reunite. They actually do reunite for a match and take on Aleister Black and a partner of his choosing who turns out to be Velveteen Dream. I think that'd be a fun match. And then at TakeOver, you could do Black challenging Ciampa for the title, which I think they are doing. And you can have on the undercard Gargano one-on-one against Velveteen Dream. It is time for the holiday mailbag as I reach into my giant sack to answer your questions. You can email me, by the way, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in if you would like to be part of my sack. Lucas from Knoxville, Tennessee. I had an idea while listening to Sound Off 577. Which was to have Seth Rollins cost Dean Ambrose the Intercontinental title during an open challenge on Raw against a debuting EC3. Rollins goes on to win the Royal Rumble while Strowman beats Brock Lesnar. And then at the Elimination Chamber, Drew McIntyre interferes to cost Strowman the championship, which Ambrose wins. This sets up Rollins against Ambrose for the Universal title at WrestleMania, Strowman against McIntyre, and EC3 defending the IC title in a 6-man ladder match. Thank you, Lucas. I am not a fan of that. I am not a fan of that at all. I am not a fan of Rollins and Ambrose at WrestleMania, not after the match they had at TLC. I was bored to tears. And the idea that you would put the Universal Championship on Dean Ambrose right now, I mean, unless something changes with him in the near future, that is not something that I would advocate doing. And also, you know, if you go with this idea, finally putting the title on Braun Strowman, only to then take it away a month later at the Elimination Chamber, that just doesn't seem right to me. Now, EC3 winning the Intercontinental title in an open challenge one week on TV, that's an idea that I can get behind. I kind of like the idea of him wearing that championship. I think it would suit him well. I think he would look good with it. But the rest of that, no, I can't get behind that. Sean from Ohio, he wants to convince me why he thinks Drew McIntyre against Braun Strowman is a better Universal title match at WrestleMania than Seth Rollins against Brock Lesnar, so have at it here. He says, I feel like McIntyre versus Lesnar would have a more big fight feel to it, and I think this would be a great time to truly make Drew McIntyre into a star. The story of this near unbeatable young star going up against the Beast, who has been dominating for years, would be a more interesting story than Rollins fighting for Roman. What do you think? It sounds to me, based on your words here, like you're advocating more for a Drew McIntyre-Brock Lesnar match than a Drew McIntyre-Braun Strowman match. I prefer the actual Beast, who has been dominating for years. I prefer to see him losing to the popular babyface. So even McIntyre and Lesnar is not a match I think that I would do at WrestleMania. I don't think Braun Strowman is a good opponent for Drew McIntyre at WrestleMania. For a WrestleMania Universal Championship match, that just it does not scream Universal title match at WrestleMania to me. It does not scream potential WrestleMania main event. It may just be that I prefer the underdog babyface getting the big title win at Mania in this case, over the heel winning it from the babyface monster. That may have something to do with it. I agree. I don't need the whole do it for Roman angle either. They could do that match without even talking about Roman Reigns, and I hope they do. But I like Rollins beating Brock and then Brock just going away. You know, they could always do Rollins defending against McIntyre sometime after WrestleMania. Or they could shake up the rosters and they can send Drew McIntyre over to the Fox show with Ronda Rousey, since apparently Fox wants Rousey on SmackDown this fall when the show debuts there. So who's to say that they don't shake things up and McIntyre switches brands? But of those two matches, I stick with what I said last week. I prefer Rollins against Lesnar. Craig in Minnesota. I've seen the debate on social media this weekend about whether or not New Japan should add its own women's division. Some are for it, some are against it, and cite many of the Joshi promotions that already operate over there. Where do you fall on this? I would love to see women's wrestling in New Japan. I know they have promotions over there like Stardom. And I know Mako Satomura runs a promotion there. I think she runs one in the UK as well. But she has a promotion over there. I think it's called Senjo, I think it is. I'm not familiar with the others, but there's a whole bunch of them. I know that. I know there used to be a ton of others like All Japan Women's Wrestling, which was very big, especially in the early 90s. They produced a lot of classic matches with Aja Kong and Bull Nakano and Manami Toyota, Ronda Singh back when she was doing the Monster Ripper gimmick, you know, before she came to WWE and they saddled her with the Bertha Faye gimmick, which I guess Vince just thought would be a funny idea. But women's wrestling in Japan has always been part of the culture there. They just traditionally separate the two. The men with the men, the women with the women. Selfishly, I would like to see it. Yes, I would. But that also would probably be bad news, I would think, for promotions like Stardom. If New Japan all of a sudden started poaching all of their good talent, that would hurt the women's promotions. That would hurt the smaller promotions. On the other hand, if New Japan is the second biggest promotion in the world, which I'm fairly confident in saying that it is right now, at least business-wise, I have to think that those ladies could be making more money than they're probably making now, working where they are. You know, but even if they start their own division, that doesn't necessarily mean that the pay scale is going to kind of be that much better. It may not be. Again, things are just very different over there. It's not a Saudi Arabia situation with WWE where the women aren't allowed to compete. It's nothing like that, so I hope nobody tries to make that comparison, because that would be dumb. It's just not, it's not a hill that I'm going to die on. If it happens, it happens. And if it doesn't, you know what? Women's wrestling will always be around over there. It may happen one day. Look, I think there's a very good chance it could happen. I see it as sort of a Dana White UFC type of situation. For years, Dana White said, we're not going to have women's matches in the UFC. He famously told TMZ, they asked him, they got him on the street one day, hey, you know, we're going to see women competing in the UFC. You know what his answer was? Never. He didn't say, oh, we'll see, or maybe one day. No, he said never. Never going to happen. We all know how that turned out. In fact, for a time, his marquee attraction was a woman. Her name was Ronda Rousey. If someone like a Rousey ever wanted to go work for New Japan, let's say Ronda Rousey, her contract expires, right? She wants to leave WWE at the end of the year. And she decides, I want to go work in Japan. I have interest in going to New Japan Pro Wrestling. I'm not saying this is going to happen. I'm just using this as an example. She is a wrestling fan, so who knows? Maybe she does watch New Japan. But let's say she wants to go there. You don't think New Japan wouldn't be interested in having Ronda Rousey working for them? Remember, it is a business. At the end of the day, it is the wrestling business. And if they ever feel they can make real money, or if business ever starts to slump like it did for New Japan in the 2000s, they went through sort of this dark era where business was just in the shitter for them for a while. You don't think that if that were to happen again, that they wouldn't consider doing some new things or trying some new things, like possibly adding their own women's division? Look, China wrestled some matches in New Japan in the 2000s. It's not like they've never had a woman competing in their ring before. She was wrestling, though, against the men. She wasn't wrestling other women. But China still had a name at that point. So, you know, if they brought in somebody like a Ronda Rousey, they would, you know, the thought would be, hey, she would be a great attraction for us. So it's not as though the idea of having a woman in New Japan is such an impossibility. It's already happened before, and it could very easily happen again. I hope it does. I hope it happens one day. I think you watch some of those Japanese women's matches, especially those from the 90s, like I mentioned. You could find them up and down on YouTube. The women, even today, wrestle as hard of a style in some cases as the men do. Go back and watch some of those old Asuka matches back from her days as Kana. Or even some of the other names I mentioned earlier. Like, you would not want to be on the receiving end of an Aja Kong spinning back fist, for example. Okay? There are some women over there that you do not want to mess with. Those ladies are tougher than some of the men. And so I think the idea of one day seeing the women, you know, competing in New Japan and having matches in the Tokyo Dome for the company could be a lot of fun. And just because the culture is different doesn't mean it's an impossibility. I think anything is possible. But I could see both sides of the coin on this. Like I said before, I could see where it would have a negative impact on a lot of the existing Joshi promotions that are over there in Japan. Look, I don't feel too passionately one way or the other about this, so this is not a discussion where I'm interested in getting into a debate with people about it. I feel that it would be fun to see the women as part of New Japan at some point. As New Japan grows and gets bigger, I would like to see that at some point. But I also see the other side of the coin, where a lot of these smaller promotions where women are already featured in their women-only promotions and women are headlining and all that stuff, I could see where they might suffer. As a result, is there some sort of happy medium? Maybe there could be some sort of working relationship between the different promotions with New Japan where they could be featured, you know, in bigger buildings or on a platform like a New Japan World, which I'm sure has a ton of more subscribers than a lot of these other streaming platforms do for these women's promotions, which is something that people may not realize, by the way. And I would suggest that everybody go ahead and check out the different Joshi promotions have their own, in many cases, streaming platforms. You know, there was a website that I came across before, you know, when I pulled this question to answer it, that I wasn't aware of previously. But if you go to joshicity.com, it's a great site because it's an entire listing of where you can watch Japanese women's wrestling online right from your home. You don't have to worry about, oh, I don't have access to it. Yeah, you do. And if you really want to check it out, and I would suggest checking out some of them, you have to pay for it, obviously, because they each cost money. But JoshiCity.com will give you a whole listing of all the different promotions and the platforms and how much subscription costs. And you could check them out that way. There are a ton of promotions out there. Again, I just answered the question as, is it something I'd like to see at some point? I would, because I think it would be a lot of fun. Maybe the way to go is to have some sort of partnership form between New Japan and some of these promotions. They don't need it. They don't need it. A lot of these women's promotions seem to be doing just fine. But New Japan is growing. It does have a bigger platform. And I do think that, you know, if maybe at some point down the road, there could be some kind of agreement where, and UFC does this also, where they'll show other promotions, and actually in some cases, I think even all female MMA leagues, on their streaming service. You know, on their Fight Pass service. Maybe it's a similar type of thing where they can get a little bit more exposure, you know, for some of these other promotions if there's some sort of business arrangement that can be reached. At the end of the day, it's all about business. You got to do what's right for business. If at some point it makes sense for New Japan to have a women's division, then they absolutely should go ahead and do it. And if it doesn't make sense for them to do it, then they shouldn't do it. There shouldn't be pressure for them to do it just because, oh, we have to have the women involved. You do it if it makes sense. They have, again, I recognize they have their own culture over there. I can accept that. The system they have in place now seems to be working okay. If, you know, maintaining the status quo and continuing with that system is the answer for everybody involved, then so be it. Chase from Rapid City, South Dakota. Will there ever be another match in WWE? Not a gauntlet match or a War Games or any match where there are multiple people involved. That will go over an hour in length. I remember watching that Omega Okada 2 out of 3 Falls match at the Dominion show and was on the edge of my seat the entire time. Even the Iron Man matches now only go 30 minutes. Do you think another hour plus match in WWE will ever happen? God, I hope not. Yeah, you said not multi-man, right? Because I enjoyed that gauntlet they did with Seth Rollins on Raw earlier this year, but that was a multi-man match. What you're saying is Chase is talking about singles matches, one-on-one matches. Will we ever see one go an hour plus again in WWE? I hope not. I hope not. I don't think people have the attention span. I barely have the attention span for it now. I don't think most fans would have the attention span for it. WWE fans. I really don't. I don't see anybody on that main roster right now, any two individuals, who would excite me enough to want to see them wrestle for an hour plus. And I love, you know, AJ Styles and, you know, Daniel Bryan and Seth Rollins, and I'm all excited Mustafa Ali is on SmackDown now. I don't want to see any two particular people in the ring for 60 or 70 minutes. I just don't have, it's not there. The excitement isn't there. I can't think of any two people I'd like to see go the distance like that. But if they were going to do it, I wouldn't want it to be an Iron Man match. I would fight tooth and nail to make sure that it wasn't an Iron Man match. I think that's a big part of why the crowd reaction is always so tepid for the first 75% of those matches when you watch them back, because you've already told people not to expect a finish. You've already told them not to expect any real drama until the very end, until the last 5 minutes or 10 minutes of the match. Because you know that match is going an hour no matter what. If you don't tell people in advance that the match is going to go an hour or more and they think it can end at any moment, to me, that's a hell of a lot more dramatic. That's what I liked about that John Cena Shawn Michaels match on Raw from the UK after WrestleMania 23. But you need the right people for it. But to do a 60-minute or 70-minute singles match today in WWE, I just don't think the fans would have the attention span for it unless you have two really good people involved who could carry a match for that long, telling the right story. But you're going to end up with a shitload of rest holds and a lot of kicking out of each other's finish, which I know annoys a lot of people. That's sort of become the WWE style. Omega and Okada made it work in front of their audience. They have great chemistry. They put on this, they really did put together this great, hard-hitting, dramatic match. And I agree, I watched that same match. It never dragged. I never got bored watching that match. Over there, it worked. In WWE, I just don't see it. Now, that also means for all of us watching at home, you know what you're also suggesting here? That unless you're in the building live watching that match, we would be watching on television. And so you're suggesting that we have an hour plus of Michael Cole, Corey Graves, and Renee Young commentary. Which sounds like a punishment more than a reward. I would never want to subject somebody to that. Alberto from Laredo, Texas. I was watching the Monday Night War episodes on the WWE Network and came across the Mick Foley episode. WWE made it seem like Mick Foley is the reason that WWE won the war. Do you feel that Mick Foley won them the war? That's a ridiculous statement to make. I mean, Mick Foley was a big part of WWE's success during the Monday Night War. He worked with Stone Cold, you know, more so as Dude Love. But when Austin won the championship, he was his first challenger. And especially that Over the Edge match they had in May of 98 is one of my favorite WWF matches of the Attitude Era. So he worked with Stone Cold, put him over. He worked with The Rock, gave him a harder edge and put him over. I mean, he beat him a few times also, but he worked with Triple H. He put all of them over. He made them all look like main eventers. He made them all look like, you know, a bunch of badasses. He did the same thing with Shawn Michaels to an extent, you know, a couple years earlier in their Mind Games match and In Your House. But by the time he and Undertaker had their Hell in a Cell match, WWE was already starting to win the war. They were already starting to win some ratings battles against WCW. Business was on the upswing. Then there's, of course, the night that he won the championship on Raw. You can thank Tony Schiavone in the Butts and Seats comment for turning 500,000 viewers over from Nitro to Raw. Foley definitely played a role, but no, he did not win the war for WWE. No one person won the war for WWE, not even Vince McMahon. It was a team effort. But more than that, it was WCW's ineptitude that lost them the war and put them out of business. If WCW knew what they were doing and they adapted and they evolved and they pushed younger guys a lot sooner than they started to there at the end and knew better how to use those big names and didn't just rely on them so much and let the NWO fester for so long. I mean, you could point to a lot of different things. Had they made all the right moves, they might still be in business today. I mean, it's hard to say. There's been so many years that have gone by since then. They wouldn't be under Turner ownership. I think we would long be past the point of Turner owning WCW. And again, now you're getting into the whole thing with TV contracts. And, you know, when they lost that TV deal, they died. So WCW could have been firing at all cylinders at the time. If Turner wanted them gone, not Turner himself, but the network executives, it almost wouldn't have even mattered. WCW could have been putting on the best product anywhere in the world. Without TV, that promotion was as good as dead. So we can't really know the answer to that question, but as far as losing the war, I think we have to keep perspective on this. Yes, WWF went Attitude, and the fans were tuning into their shows more often, and they had all these great stars all at once, and that played, and the Mr. McMahon character, and it was a huge thing. But more than anything, WCW shot itself in the foot, and that's really what killed them. To suggest, though, that Mick Foley won the war for WWE is ridiculous. But he definitely played a part in it. Jay from the UK. If Seth Rollins faces Brock Lesnar for the Universal title at WrestleMania, should Kurt Angle face Drew McIntyre for embarrassing him on Raw several weeks ago? If the plan was for Braun Strowman to face Drew, Strowman instead could face a debuting Lars Sullivan in a classic big man versus big man battle at WrestleMania. Well, by that logic, that would imply that Lars is going to Raw and not SmackDown. I don't approve of that. I would rather he go to SmackDown. And doing Kurt Angle against Drew McIntyre again, no, I would rather they not do that. I would rather they not do that. They got it right the first time. Kurt put this guy over like $1 million. He looked pretty bad in that match. But Drew got to dominate and beat Kurt Angle. Beat him with his own move. There's no bigger, better way to put somebody over than what Kurt Angle did for him on television. So, you know, been there, done that. Already saw the outcome that we needed to see. For Kurt to come back and beat him, I mean, Kurt's looking his age in the ring these days, let's be honest. I don't even know if he should have a singles match at WrestleMania. Why undo what you did on television? Because I don't see Kurt Angle losing a second time. So why have Kurt beat Drew McIntyre? And let's say Drew wins a second time. What does that accomplish? You've already beaten the guy once. So I don't see the need to do that match. Philly from Houston, Texas. I've heard so much about how great of a technical wrestler Steve Austin was before the Stone Cold era. What are some matches you recommend watching from those days? He wants to know what matches from the Steve Austin mechanic days that I would recommend. Definitely watch the War Games match from 1992. It was Sting's Squadron against the Dangerous Alliance. Austin was only one part of that match, but it's one of the best matches in WCW history. So definitely watch that. There was a Clash of the Champions match with Steve Austin and Ricky Steamboat that I would... Actually, no, it wasn't Clash of the Champions. It was Bash at the Beach. I think Austin and Steamboat did have a Clash of the Champions match, but I remember their Bash at the Beach match in 94, I think, being better. So him and Steamboat at Bash at the Beach is one I would suggest. And there was a Clash of the Champions match with the Hollywood Blondes. Steve Austin and Brian Pillman against Ric Flair and Arn Anderson. So those are three fine choices right there. I mean, there's probably others I could think of. And some of these I remember, if only because when I did my WCW countdown a couple years back, there were some Austin matches on there, I think, and I watched a lot of WCW from that era when I put that list together. So those are three that should get you started there. Mike from Long Island City. Do you think it's too much for WWE to have two battle royals at WrestleMania, one for the men and one for the women, seeing as how we now have two Royal Rumble matches? And is there a better way to get all of the women on the card? No, there really isn't. Not without taking up more time than they probably have. If they insist on getting everybody on the show, then a battle royal is the quickest and the easiest way to do it. Honestly, I mean, is it too much? Yeah, of course it is. It's overkill. I mean, you think about it. You're basically having four battle royals in the first 3 months of the year. That's a lot. That's a lot. And don't forget, two Elimination Chamber matches in between. Now, if they allow the intergender wrestling stuff, which I'm not the biggest fan of myself, but, you know, hey, if they allowed it, ideally, you know what they would do? You want a real special attraction? You want to save space and time on the card? You would fuse the two together, and you would have 15 men and 15 women in one battle royal, with the winner getting a future title opportunity. And you would allow pinfalls and submissions the way that Lucha Underground does in those Aztec Warfare matches, since it might be tough for some of the women to get some of those guys out over the top. Some of them can, no problem. But I could see that being an issue if Alexa Bliss, for example, is... You know, trying to lift, Mojo Rawley out of the ring. I could see where that might be a little difficult. Obviously, this is not going to happen. It's just a thought. I do want to say, though, you know, we're getting closer to WrestleMania, and I want to put out there my idea from earlier this year, because I fear people may have forgotten, and I want to get this out into the public conscious and get this trending here, which was to call the Women's Battle Royal the Sensational Invitational. As a tribute to Sherri Martel. They had named it after Moolah, and after all the fan pressure and Snickers or Mars, the parent company, got involved, they took the Moolah name off of it, as they should have, and they didn't really have enough time to name it after anybody else, so they just called it the Women's Battle Royal. Well, they have the Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal every year. If you're going to pay homage to someone, you already pay homage to Mae Young with the Mae Young Classic. Why not honor somebody who I think is still very underrated for her contributions to wrestling and really never gets talked about at all on WWE television? Think about all the women's stuff, all the video packages, the Evolution show. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't remember there being a single mention or a single piece of footage that aired that included Sherri Martel. And maybe there was, but it certainly doesn't stand out in my mind. She certainly does not get talked about and get any sort of, you know, the kind of recognition that I think she probably should. Let's call it the Sensational Invitational as a tribute to her. Steve from Green Bay, Wisconsin. While online shopping for Christmas presents this year, I came across an action figure of Andre the Giant under a mask as billed as the Giant Machine. I didn't know he was ever under a mask. Why was Andre under a mask in 1986 pretending to be Japanese? Did people not realize that it was Andre? First of all, where are you Christmas shopping that you found a figure of Andre the Giant as Giant Machine? I must know this. But this was from an angle that, yes, people knew it was Andre. This was from an angle that WWE ran in the mid-80s, where Bobby Heenan lobbied President Jack Tunney, back when authority figures were real authority figures, and they only showed up when they had to. He lobbied President Tunney to suspend Andre after he had no-showed. There was a tag team match against two of his Heenan family members. I think it might have been Bundy and Stud. And Andre no-showed. And so Tunney suspended him. And then a couple of months later, all of a sudden, out of the blue, this new team pops up called the Machines. You had Super Machine. Super Machine was played by Bill Eadie, who would go on to become Axe from Demolition. And you had Giant Machine, who was very clearly played by Andre the Giant. This is very much like the Mr. America angle that WWE did many years later with Hulk Hogan or Dusty Rhodes as the Midnight Rider, where the fans are not stupid. You know, they know who it is. And the heels have to try to prove it. And typically, they usually don't. They usually are not able to prove that it's the babyface. What's funny is that they had a whole bunch of different people playing different machines. They even had Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan played Hulk Machine for a time. I think Roddy Piper did some matches as Piper Machine. It was completely ridiculous, but it was funny as hell. And I think that's really what's missing from the show today, right? Fun. Where'd all the fun go? How come things seemed like they were more fun back then? But that's why I love Kurt Angle as the Conquistador so much a few months ago. I know some people shit all over it and thought it was stupid. I loved it because it reminded me of some of what got me into wrestling in the first place, right? It wasn't great. Let's be honest here. I'll speak for myself. I'm willing to bet that the same applies for most people listening to this right now. When you were younger, when you were a kid, and this would be a great question to put to all of you. What was it that got you into wrestling? What was it that made you a wrestling fan? What was it, if you were a WWF fan, that got you into WWF? It wasn't great wrestling that got me into WWF. It was the colorful characters. It was Hulkamania. It was the storylines. It was all of that stuff. Now, I'm older now, so I have a lot less patience for crappy wrestling, but I'm still interested in all those things I was interested in back then. Colorful characters and charismatic personalities and good storytelling. That hasn't changed. So ask yourself that question. What got you into wrestling in the first place? You know, maybe when you got into wrestling, you weren't that young. You weren't like super young. You were old enough where if you were an NWA fan, you came to appreciate the in-ring action in the NWA because they were far less reliant, I think, just on colorful characters and comedy stuff and things like that that WWF might have been. And so you probably have a lot of NWA fans who grew up hating WWF because they thought it was a clown show. They probably thought it was a total circus. And they loved the serious storylines and the matches and the war games and all that. Okay, so you may have people who fall into that category, but I'm willing to bet a lot of people who were young wrestling fans getting into WWF for the first time were not watching it because, oh, I can't wait to see Ted DiBiase and, you know, Jake Roberts have a four-star match. That wasn't what it was about. It was about things like this. Goofy things, true, but things like this. Anyway, Andre was really hurting around this time. That's part of why they did this, to give him some time off. His back was in really bad shape. Giant Machine really wasn't around a whole lot. They had a lot of other machines who did most of the matches. But Giant Machine would pop up from time to time while, you know, Andre was on suspension. And when he was reinstated, Heenan pushed for it so that Andre could turn on Hulk Hogan, and that then led to their match at WrestleMania 3. James from Staten Island, I know for years you always talked about wanting to see The Undertaker face John Cena while the streak was still intact. I offer you a what-if scenario. What if, instead of Batista, The Undertaker would have chosen John Cena after he won the Royal Rumble in 2007? Do you think WWE would have had Cena break the streak, or would Undertaker have gone 15-0? Do you think the match would have been any good, or as good as the match he had with Batista? And he said it would have been weird to see Undertaker with the spinner title. What do you think? Yeah, you know what? It would have been really fucking weird to see Undertaker wearing that spinner belt, especially if the spinning mechanism was still in it. They would have had to change that thing because that would have just been completely ridiculous. But I do think Undertaker would have won. I don't think they would have ended the streak. I think he and Cena would have had a very good match. I can't say whether it would have been better than him and Batista. I think it had the potential to be. You got to remember, Undertaker and Batista were extra motivated that night because they were pissed. They were pissed that they didn't go on last, that they were not the main event of the show. And so that probably gave them a little extra oomph to go out there and have the kind of match they had. But I still think Undertaker and Cena would have been a very good match. I think Undertaker would have won. And I think he would have gone 15-0. And I think he would have had the spinner belt initially. And hopefully they would have come up with some kind of a... either a unique design for him or they would have gone back to a traditional design, because I cannot picture the Undertaker with that god-awful thing strapped around his waist.
It's time to rumble! It's time for the Royal Rumble!
We are down to match number 6 of 10 in our top 10 countdown of the greatest championship matches in Royal Rumble history. Last week, number 7 in the countdown took us back to 2017 and John Cena's 16th world title win over AJ Styles. And so this week, number 6 in the countdown takes us back 10 years before that to the Royal Rumble in 2007 and the last man standing match for the WWE Championship. Only this time it was John Cena defending the title against the Samoan Bulldozer Umaga. Or as William Regal would say, Umanga. And before he was Umanga, he was in WWE years earlier as Jamal. He was one half of 3 Minute Warning with his partner Rosie, who was the brother, of course, of Roman Reigns. When I reflect back on Umaga's career, he was part of a few big matches and moments, quite a few in WWE history. The Billy and Chuck wedding segment on SmackDown is one of the more memorable angles, I think, in the history of that show. He was part of that. He did a run-in. He was one half of what had been, before Cena and Rock in Miami, the biggest box office attraction in WrestleMania history, that Battle of the Billionaires match against Bobby Lashley. Umaga was Vince McMahon's surrogate in the match against Donald Trump's surrogate, Bobby Lindsay, as Trump called him once. And then this match here, which really is one of the best matches in Royal Rumble history. After he left the company, I know he went to TNA for a while. He went to Japan for a little bit. He came back in 2006, and they gave him the Umaga gimmick. And I always wondered, you know, if the reason for this was because they were interested in Samoa Joe, and maybe they couldn't get Samoa Joe, or, you know, again, maybe that's just an old wives' tale. I don't know if they were interested in him or not. I kind of would joke that if Joe ever did come to WWE, they would just kind of call him Joe Maga and put him in that gimmick. Thankfully, that did not happen. It didn't happen probably because he went to NXT first. He had enough sense to go there first before he hit the main roster. But they gave him the Umaga gimmick, and he went undefeated for all of 2006 until meeting John Cena in a singles match for the very first time at New Year's Revolution at the beginning of 2007, and they had a match, and Umaga just completely dominated until he got rolled up. It was like a fluke roll-up by John Cena for the shock pin. That handed him his very first loss, his first pinfall loss. And this here, at the Royal Rumble, a few weeks later, was the rematch. Umaga was probably the first person, first monster, who really was really groomed to be fed, I would say, to John Cena. Years later, it would be Rusev in the same spot. Rusev went undefeated for a year until he ran into the brick wall that was John Cena. And, you know, for a guy who went undefeated for so long, the beginning of 2007, when you look back, was not very kind to Umaga from a win-loss perspective in big matches. He lost to John Cena twice in 1 month that January. First at New Year's Revolution, and then again here at the Royal Rumble. And then at WrestleMania, he lost to Bobby Lashley. I'm sure he got a nice big fat payday out of it. But win-loss-wise, not a very strong start to the new year for Umaga. Cena was right in the middle of the Cena sucks Cena can't wrestle, hate that was going on with the fans here in this era. And yet, when this match was over, to show you how good it really was, people largely cheered him. And I think probably respected him a little bit more, at least as far as being able to put on a great match against somebody not named Kurt Angle and against somebody not named Shawn Michaels. So it was quite the sight to see, because he definitely got boos coming out, and this was in the middle of the whole Boo Birds period, which would go on for many years. But yeah, you watch as the match went on towards the end, and then when it was over, the fans gave him a standing ovation. And Cena came into this match, his ribs were all taped up from an earlier attack on Raw by Umaga. He sold his ass off with these ribs for a good part of the match. It was kind of sluggish at the beginning because of all the selling and just... That's all he was doing. He was getting beaten up by Umaga and selling and selling. And, you know, when I think of the use of steel steps, which is when this match really started to pick up, I always think of this match. It always reminds me when I see the steps being thrown into the ring and thrown around and being used as a weapon. It always makes me think of this match. The steps were a very big part of this match. They were propped up in the corner at one point. They were slamming each other onto them. There was this wicked spot where Umaga was standing outside the ring. And Cena picked the steps up. He lifted them up and he launched them out of the ring right into Umaga's face. It was this great bump. Thankfully got his hands up, or else that would have ended very badly for him. Cena went for an AA on the steps, or I guess an FU it was still called back then. That's WWE's favorite move they like to use on the fans. But Umaga was too heavy. Cena fell face first onto the steps. And when he came up, he was bleeding all over the place. He was bleeding like a stuck pig. And boy, did he bleed. Boy, did he bleed. You know, it is also funny. When you go back and watch the match, because I go back and I've watched all of these matches over again because I had to rank them. So I wanted to see where the appropriate spot would be. So I watched this match now twice in the last few weeks. And when Cena comes up bloody after clearly blading himself, you hear Jim Ross on commentary. He actually says Cena blades, but then he catches himself. And then he says, oh, Cena bleeds or Cena's bleeding. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And he did bleed. I mean, Cena has bled a few gushers in his career. The match with JBL at Judgment Day in 05 stands out to me. This was another one. His face was just drenched in blood. And he hulked up at one point. He started punching himself in the head to psych himself up, face full of blood, told Umaga to give him some more. He was firing himself up. The crowd was just eating this whole thing up here. And the crowd was fully behind him at that point. It's just too bad the same thing didn't work for Roman Reigns in his match with Brock Lesnar this year at WrestleMania. Remember, Roman was bleeding all over the place. He bled a gusher too. Didn't matter. Fans did not care. They probably didn't care because the match sucked. One of the worst WrestleMania main events you'll ever see. But what worked for Cena back then did not work for Roman this year. He grabbed, Cena did, a television monitor off the announce desk at one point. He whacked Umaga in the head with it. And later on, Cena found himself laid out across the English announce desk. Umaga cleared off the other two announce tables that were sitting beside it. And he ran across both announce desks, and he did a belly flop onto the third one. But Cena rolled out of the way, and the table collapsed under the guy's weight. So you had Armando Alejandro Estrada outside in Umaga's corner. He was Umaga's manager. He was his mouthpiece. He was out there on the apron loosening the top rope. So now, all of a sudden, the top rope snaps. We have no top rope. And he hands Umaga one of the steel beams, one of the steel rods from one of the corners to use as a weapon. But when he comes at Cena, Cena catches him, hits a giant AA, and then Cena grabs the steel rod. He whacks Umaga across the back with it, which elicited an impromptu goddamn from Jim Ross on commentary. That's what he said. He got very animated here. And then came the finish, which was tremendous. And appropriately violent, I thought, for a match with this stipulation. You know, it's jarring to go back and watch because WWE, not only do they not allow choking anymore, they haven't allowed choking since 2007, the very same year that this match took place. You know, later on after the Benoit murders, That was one of the things that they did not allow. It's one of the reasons why Daniel Bryan was briefly fired in 2010 when they did the Nexus angle and he choked out Justin Roberts with his own tie. For some odd reason, they still allow choke slams, but they do not allow choking in WWE matches. And so to go back and watch John Cena here wrapping the top rope around Umaga's neck, around his throat, and yanking back like he's trying to rip this guy's head off, yeah, it's pretty jarring. He's got him in the STFU with that rope wrapped around his throat. He's just choking the life out of Umaga. Jim Ross had a great line in here where he said, "Even a monster's got to breathe." I just thought that was such a great line. Umaga's eyes start rolling into the back of his head. His tongue is sticking out. He's gasping for air. Finally, he passes out. And it's a last man standing match. So the referee starts the 10 count. About midway through, Umaga starts to waken. Somehow. So Cena wraps the rope back around his throat again and chokes him out again. And this time, Umaga did not answer the referee's 10 count. John Cena wins. And the crowd erupts into wild cheers for John Cena. They erupt into cheers. That right there is one of the best matches of John Cena's career. And a few months later, he would have another best match of his career. This time against Shawn Michaels in the UK. Their WrestleMania match was very good also, but it was not the sort of classic match I think that their Raw match is. Umaga, I feel, is somewhat underrated for the talent that he had. I always thought the Samoan Savage gimmick was just way too goofy. Even in 2006, I felt we were long past that. That Umaga character felt like something that was lifted out of 1989 WWE. And it always felt so out of place. It felt completely out of place at WrestleMania 23. You know, you had Vince McMahon and Donald Trump, and you knew that this was going to get a lot of mainstream publicity. And I just remember thinking to myself, of all the people to put in that match, you're going with the goofy Umaga gimmick. It just never really made a lot of sense to me. But goofy though it may have been, he made it work. He had real talent. You know, that same year, he had some great matches with Jeff Hardy, I remember, for the IC title. Those two work real well together. Part of the reason why I hope Jeff Hardy and Samoa Joe can work well together now. And, you know, it's a shame that he passed away at such a young age. He was only 36 when he died. But go back and watch this match. I enjoyed this way more than I did that plodding last man standing match between Shawn Michaels and Triple H from the 2004 Royal Rumble. I know that's going to upset some people. That's sacrilegious for me to say for some people, but it's true. Next week will be the final sound off of 2018. We don't skip a week here. We don't take no weeks off here on this show. So we're going to have the final show next week. I don't know that I'm going to actually spend much time actually watching Raw or SmackDown next week because they're taped shows on Christmas and New Year's, and I don't really want to waste too much time watching them if I watch them at all. However, I will be doing my year in review and my list of the top 10 matches of 2018. So that's going to be big. Plus, I'm going to be doing a preview for Wrestle Kingdom 13. That's coming up in the next few weeks. So we'll do a preview for that next week as well. And maybe some other things too. So even if I don't cover Raw and SmackDown, there's going to be plenty of content on next week's show. Probably that plus number 5 in the Royal Rumble countdown. We're now down to the bottom 5. The top 5 championship matches in Royal Rumble history. What will number 5 be? So a lot of good stuff coming up next week. The week after that, that's the first show of 2019. That's the January 6th episode of the Sound Off. I think that'll be episode 580. That will be a normal show, but we'll also do predictions. That'll be the prediction show for 2019. We look back on my predictions from last year. Which ones did I get right? Which ones did I get very wrong? I don't shy away from that. We'll talk about all that, and then we'll do predictions for the new year. And the Royal Rumble countdown, of course, will continue until we reveal the number one match, the Sunday of the 2019 Royal Rumble. So a lot of good stuff coming up. I hope all of you listening have a very Merry Christmas for those of you who celebrate. I myself will be enjoying a Chinese food dinner on Tuesday night and taking in a little bit of Law & Order SVU, a little Law & Order SVU marathon. For those of you who are curious, I've had a couple people ask me about this. In going back and starting from the beginning, some people remember it. I said that I was going back and catching up on all the episodes I never got to see of SVU. Well, I'm happy to say that I am on the verge of finishing season 12 of the show. I have one more to go. That's season 13. And at that point, I will be all caught up on the old episodes. And I can then pick up where I left off with season 18. So what happened is, many, many, many months ago, Netflix added Law & Order SVU. And I am bored to shit when I'm commuting to and from work. I sit on a bus for 2 hours. And so what do? I find things to watch. I find things to consume. Like an alien species going from planet to planet. I just consume. And you can only consume so much wrestling. So I started getting into some Netflix stuff. I saw SVU on there. And I got all excited until I realized that it was only starting from season 14. And I said, well, I guess we'll start from season 14. And by that point, Stabler wasn't on the show, and Munch was retiring on one of the episodes, and even the captain, Captain Cragen, was on his way out soon, and I feel like I missed out on so much. And so I said, well, I'm going to have to go back at some point and catch up on all of the first 13 seasons that I missed. That's why I've been doing this. And so 12 seasons just about done, 13 will be after that. And then we'll be all caught up, and then we can go back. And I think I left off with the middle of season 18. And what are they up to? I think they're up to season 20 now, or 21. So at some point next year, I will be all caught up on Law & Order SVU. And you know what that means. Once I'm all caught up on SVU, I get to go back and start with the original Law & Order from 1990. I've got a lot of Law & Order to catch up on. That should keep me occupied on those long commutes. But yeah, 12 seasons worth of sex crimes. Merry Christmas, everyone. Be well, stay safe, enjoy the holiday, and I will see you guys back here for the year-end podcast next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the Big Show of TV shows. It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Solomonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.